Hello and welcome to Boothcast. On Boothcast, I speak to people who've inspired me about sport, business, and the winning mindset. Today's Boothcast is brought to you by Booth Training. Booth Training is your online paddle hub where you can get better and reach your goals. Today on Boothcast, I have Ivan Lawler, all the way from the UK. He's a six-time world championship medalist, world championship gold medalist. He is a three-time Olympian, and he is a very avid ski paddler. He has a paddling shop. He has a coaching business. He has an MBE for his services to canoeing. He is a guy who's basically given his life to paddling, and I'm very lucky to have him on the line. Ivan, thanks for coming on.
I really appreciate you having me on, Michael. I mean, I got to this really through watching Hank's interview with you the other day. Obviously, I've got a direct interest in Hank coming from my background as well. And since then, I've looked at a couple of the others. I really love what you're doing. I think it's great to put it all out there. I hope don't let you down.
No, I'm sure you won't. I've obviously heard your name a lot in the paddling circles, especially in the marathon paddlers. They obviously hold you in high regard. Can you tell us a little bit about your paddling background and where you grew up and how you got involved in sports? I know you're from a sporting family.
Yeah, I was born into a paddling family, essentially. My dad tried to be a paddler, and if you talk to him, he's a self-confessed terrible one. But he loves the coaching. He's coached me through my whole career, really. Well, totally through my whole career. My uncle was probably my inspiration from a kid. He went to three Olympics himself in Tokyo, Mexico and Munich back in the day. And I remember little trinkets that I had as gifts from him coming back from those that were really important to me as a kid. I had a little commemorative Munich commemorative medal by my bed for a long time. And they were just really special items. And that kind of put in me the idea that I quite fancy doing three Olympics was my Olympic goal, if you like. Yeah. And lucky enough to crack that.
And you grew up in the UK, I assume. What was it like growing up there as a paddler?
I was embedded in the sport as a paddler here. It's a really active scene. Primarily marathon based, because that's the type of water we've got. Marathons back then were down rivers as well as flat water, and obviously they've evolved over the years now into being pretty sterile affairs as far as the actual, you know, venues are concerned. Yeah, it was very easy to get into. Clubs around, there's plenty of clubs, there's plenty of activity. It's a great little scene. It's pretty much worldwide. They describe it as a canoeing family, don't they? You get welcomed in if you're interested. And once you're in, you can go anywhere, see anyone, talk to anyone. There's no bars and no hurdles to jump across to get to anyone. So yeah, it was easy to get into.
And when did you pick up your first kayak?
They were always available. I'm looking back and thinking back to old photos. I reckon there's photos of me in a kayak around the age 6, 7, something like that. You know, racing K1, literally up to my armpits in it, just sort of dangling over the top, sitting on the bottom of the boat.
And I
had flat blades for a lot longer than most, to be fair, Mike. Well, I'm a bit late on a lot of the trends when it comes to changing equipment and stuff. But that had to change, obviously, once I started selling it. Right now, I'm right on button. I'm up there with the best. But I didn't see it as a sport originally. I got into sports my parents put me into swimming first, probably because they didn't want me to drown if I started the canoeing. But and then all boys in England and a lot of other countries, football is a big thing as well. So I didn't really see myself as a canoeist for quite a long time.
And where did you grow up in the UK? Is it near London or was it?
Just on the outskirts of London. So for the guys who sort of travel worldwide, Richmond was my first club.
Okay.
My parents sort of were coaches and managers down at the club there for a long time. And then they left and started their own club about 20, 30 miles up the Thames from there.
I was actually lucky to paddle there. I paddled there with Sean Rice, I think back in 2017, I think before he went and won his first Molokai. Yeah. So that was a cool experience. So I was over there racing on the Thames, I think, for an APP event. So yeah, it's funny how you just mentioned that. And I was like, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly what the bends are like.
And yeah, if you've been there for any length of time and you've left that landing stage out the front of that club with an outgoing tide, yeah, you paddle there in a K1, you can paddle anywhere in a K1. You've got to have nerves of steel to let go of that landing stage some days. So yeah, it's a great upbringing in sports. It's a good club. It's always been a good club. And yeah, it served me very well.
And
we mixed it. All the best guys were there as well. So real training was very visible to me, and I think that's really important for kids.
And who were the guys you were looking up to when you were sort of, I don't know, in your late teens, when you started to progress and started to become better? Who were the guys you were looking up to?
It depends what event you're talking about, really. I mean, my first real inspirational people, we had the World Championships here in 1981 in sprint. And I got to watch that really close because I was in the commentary car, as it happens, just giving out names to the actual commentator so he knew what was happening. And the main guy there, Russian guy, Vladimir Parfenovich, he won 3 Olympic golds in Moscow up until Rio, actually. He's the only person to win 3 golds at 1 Olympics. He was a phenomenon. But it was the 10K races there, Milan Yannick, whose daughter now, Natasha Yannick, still races, and his sons have both been Olympians as well. That was the first really inspirational moment for me, watching the 10Ks there with him. He had his paddle broken after maybe 1 lap of 3. The wooden paddles back then, it split right down the middle, so he had half a blade on one side.
Yeah.
And I just remember watching him, and it didn't faze him one bit. He still came in with a medal, and I just thought, yeah, hallelujah. I want to be part of that game. That's the game I love. And yeah, so that's what I always wanted to be. I wanted to do that 10K. K1 10K, that's me.
So K1 10K was at the World Championships each year, because I know it's not there anymore. I think they have a 5K. Yeah. What was like the appeal for the 10K for you? Obviously, you've watched that race and you really wanted to do that, but did you always have like good endurance, or was it just something that you went, I watched that race and that's what I wanted to do all of a sudden?
Oh, I think it's, for me, it looked like a game. So that there were, it was how well they played the game that made the difference. It wasn't their physicality. It wasn't strength. It wasn't any of those sort of basic things. It was a game that played out. It's like a dance almost, and you had to work it out. So there's a strategy as well as a physicality about it. I could see that, you know, if a guy with half a paddle can still get a medal, there's more to this than meets the eye, you know? And that's it's the same in marathon. It's just a bit elongated, but it's the game that fascinates me. And how well you play the game dictates how well you do in the end, not how well you've necessarily trained or prepared or any of that. All that helps. But if you don't understand the game, you haven't got it.
It was always fascinating, actually, paddling with guys like Hank and in the Cape Point Challenge. That was my biggest learning experience, when they were like darting through rocks and stopping and starting and like fully stopping and then like going again. And I was just like, what are these guys doing? And that's the game
sense.
You're talking about. Yeah.
And yeah, I've been in races where you've ended up paddling backwards up the river. And you think, yeah, guys, this clearly makes no sense. But
yeah,
game. And yeah, I think, I say, you know, they took 10Ks out, which obviously was heartbreaking to me. I only ever got to race 1, actually, in my K1. And then they took it out for a few years. Then they put 5K back in. But in the meantime, they've lost the skill set. Mm. And back in the 10K day, it was like watching, like I say, a ballet or a dance of some sort. Now it's like watching a bloody mosh pit, you know. It's just like, all that is chaos without any real like goal or any... It's the level of skill in it is painful to watch.
And And what was your first 10K that you went to be able to represent Britain? You watched that one in 81, and then you had obviously an opportunity to go compete yourself. When was the first time you went to compete at a national level for Great Britain?
In 10K seniors, we did sort of junior stuff. I was sort of tail end of junior, and they used to do 6K. So that used to be the only thing I'd have any degree of success at all, because I was too small to sprint at the time. Senior-wise, in 1987, I raced K4 10K, which in itself is an exciting thing just for the sheer number of people in such a small space. It was massively frustrating because I was put in the second seat with a driver in the front seat that I didn't have a lot of faith in. And you just, like, you know, mainstream backseat driver. But yeah, even worse than that, the coach had said to me, tell him where to go. And you think, just put me in the front, man.
Yeah,
let me do my job. But no, I'd second seat. Actually, we did really well in the end. We came sixth. And yeah, and then the year, that was 87, 88, Olympic year, no 10Ks. And then 89, K2 10K with Grayson Bourne, a kayak pro guy now. And yeah, then we were starting to be good. And then all that's luck, how all that fell together. But yeah, the luck comes and you make the most of it.
You speak of the kayak pro. I've actually got a kayak pro supper to go out the back just in case we got full lockdown. I was like onto it straight away so I could make sure I could train. So that was a good little point in there. But so you're racing K4 10Ks. I didn't even know that was a thing. So how was that turning? Obviously, the turning circuit was in K4s.
It was madness. So you'd start, you know, I can't remember. You'd have 20 to 30 boats across the line. So times that by four for the number of people and paddles.
Yeah.
Typically, they'd start, and within 200 metres, there'd be a collision of three or four. One would sink, and then the race would carry on. And first turn was just mayhem. And, yeah, I don't know. It kind of played out always. Yeah. At the Worlds in 81 was actually the first medal the UK had ever got at World Championships. That was in the K4 10K. And so that, again, was inspirational to me. So to have the K410 as my first race at World Championship level was kind of exciting, really, and just to be part of something that chaotic that does pan out in the end.
Yeah,
it's not dissimilar, I guess, to, you know, I've seen some of the surf life-saving things where it just appears to be chaos, but then all of a sudden pans out into something that's quite organized.
Yeah, it's like an organized chaos, essentially.
Yeah.
But So you're born in 67, would that be right?
Late 66, yeah, November 66. 19th, if anyone wants to send me a present.
Yeah, so when did you start to realise that you wanted to be a paddler? Obviously, you were paddling when you were younger, but when did you realise that you wanted to start taking it seriously and you wanted to go onto that national level, you wanted to win events? Like, was it a gradual process, or was it like as soon as you jumped in a boat because of your family, because of your background, that's just what your path was straight away?
No, it definitely wasn't my path straight away. Swimming was my first sport along with football. And I guess swimming, I had no concept of whether I was good, bad or indifferent. I was just a club swimmer and I was one of the better ones in my club. And that was a really strange experience, because I remember when that kind of ended for me. We were still probably only 10 years old at the time. Competed club event next to a guy called Timothy Mandeville. I'll never forget his name, because just like some things stick in your head. And we dived in and I looked across and his trunks had fallen down to his knees. And we were level pretty much the whole way. But the whole way I was thinking, shit, man, I'd stop and pull mine up. This guy cares. You know, it became apparent to me that it mattered to him way more than it mattered to me.
Yeah.
And that was a real awakening in that. And I realized that, you know, maybe swimming's not my thing. And then in the football, similar sort of thing, really. I was played for Sunday team, school teams, like every kid in England does. And then along comes a guy, he says, oh, no, you need to come down to the Southampton Football Academy and come and see us down there. And we've on this thing, and mate, at that stage I'm the most gifted footballer that's ever lived, you know, bring it on. And
yeah,
so we went down to this academy camp at Southampton Football Club obviously a bit of a privilege to go, and probably 200 kids there. And it became increasingly apparent that I was probably ranked 200th out of the 200 kids. And
yeah.
And all of a sudden, you meet people who are genuinely gifted at a sport. You know, I was a trier, I guess, but they were gifted. It was a sport they were born to do. And slowly, you know, as you fell out of love with those other sports, the kayaking grew in status. And I realized I was quite good at it. And I don't think that was based, well, obviously wasn't based on results because I wasn't getting any. But something in me said, you know what? You're good at this. This is it. And I never thought or aimed to win anything. I think that was my dad's influence, but
yeah,
just to get better at it. And if you got, again, I guess if you keep getting better at it, sooner or later, there's less people better than you.
And was it down to sort of like you were working harder than everybody else? Like you were doing more work? Like you, obviously you had this passions, obviously in swimming and in soccer, but then obviously your underlying passion was paddling. Because like it's quite interesting for me to listen to that you jumped in a kayak when you were like really young. Like that doesn't happen in Australia. Like everyone sort of goes through the surf club thing and then sort of jumps in at like 16, 17 maybe if they like it, or they jump in like after 20, you know, like, so we don't really have that background. But you were obviously paddling your whole life on the Richmond on the river there. When did you sort of get your first result where you were like, okay, maybe I can do this, maybe I can win a world title?
That's a big question. I didn't get results for an awfully long time. I guess my first real result that I thought, hello, I'm onto something here. I was still a junior at the time. There was a 2-day race in Denmark called the Tour de Gardena over a few stages. I think it's about 90K on, I can't remember if it's 90K or 90 miles. It felt like 90 miles, but it was probably 90K.
Yeah.
That's how most races are, isn't it? And at that time, the GB guys, Alan Williams, Rod Kinch, they were top. Alan Williams was top in the world anyway. And then our other guys were in the top five or six. And the juniors and seniors started together. And mass start, big lakes. Got left behind because I was a junior. The seniors were off and gone. But then this K2, I think it was Danish or Dutch K2, had sunk. And they came out from the side of the lake. Mate, I'm like a limpet on a wash. That's one thing I can do. I learned that. You learn that skill when you're a shit canoeist, I tell you. Because it's the only way to keep up. So I latched onto them, and we were just hauling through the field on this. I was basically surfing, it felt like.
Yeah.
I was some kind of circus midget at that age, and they were big fat boys in a K2, and man, I'm hardly paddling. So we got to the stage stop, and there's these sort of Alan Williams, Rod Kinch type guys who were the big names at the time. And I guess I've always had a little bit of something in me, a little bit of irritation factor, something. So I remember going to the stage stop and saying, guys, I'll be catching you up in a minute. And they looked to me, and you could see them thinking, yeah, shut up. But sure enough, on the next stage, we gradually caught them up. Could see them just being reeled in by this K2. I thought, yeah, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Caught them up and made a point of saying, hello, told you so. And by the end of the day, Alan Williams won the day. Rod Kinch was 2 seconds in front of me. Anyway, the next day followed on, long day. I remember just before the finish, Rod Kinch says to me, looked to me, and I could tell he was nervous about it. He said, look, if you beat me, it's the last thing you'll ever do. And I thought, right, game on. This is it. And I remember trying harder than I'd ever tried just to beat him at the finish there. And I failed. But
yeah,
I was third overall in this race that was basically one of the biggest marathon races of the time. And I was still a junior. And I thought, wow, you know, this can be done. And it can be done not by being physically the best. It can be done by doing it the best. And that was what was so exciting to me, because I didn't ever think I would have the physicality to be the best. So I was a really small kid.
So that's when you started to really learn about the game in a way, because you were able to latch onto that K2 and not let go, and it sort of really pulled you back into that field and allowed you to sort of show your face in that name. So I always talk to different people, it's like you sort of start at the back of the pack and then you sort of move into that like sort of 10 to 6 and then you sort of go, okay, maybe I start to feel, and then you start to feel comfortable in that 10 to 6 and then you go, maybe I go to the front of that pack, and then you start going into that like front pack of 6 and then you go, okay, maybe I'm comfortable at the front of that pack, and then all of a sudden you find yourself out in front. Was that sort of like a gradual process that you had as well?
Yeah, it's really, I mean, you talk about that and it's where your brain expects you to be in that pack, in that field. And that's where you end up. You know, your body, I always think of it, that your body follows your brain into battle. It's not the other way around. So it's not the results that come first and that reassures you. It's the brain goes to that place. That's where I belong. And if you belong there, you go there. And there's a bizarre sort of self-fulfillment to that. You think, right, I'm here because I expect to be. And we all do it in training. And you see it with people in training. Wherever you are in that pecking order, it's acceptable for one person to beat you. But it's not acceptable for the other guy. That guy will never beat me. And I'd rather die. But if the guy who you accept is better than you beats you, you accept it.
Yeah, no big deal. So,
I always think your brain takes you to where you're going to go, and your body follows the rules. And
what was it? What year was this when you did finish this tour of the Gina? Sorry if I probably said it wrong, but
I say it wrong as well. There's a way of saying it. It's a Danish thing.
Yeah,
you know, we can be, when you only speak English.
Yeah,
you get away with that sort of shit, don't you?
I have to, otherwise I got no other choice, do I? Yeah.
So that would have been, I would have been 18, so 85, something like that. Yeah, 84, 85.
Yeah. And then you went, and then you ended up sort of moving into that sort of Olympic, I guess, form, because you went to your first Olympics back in 86, I think it was.
Yeah, 88, first one, 88. Yeah.
And what was that sort of leading like? Because that's obviously 3 years later, you start obviously to really step up your game and you start becoming obviously a really fast paddler. You start representing Britain, you start winning obviously events in the place. What changed after that? Was it that changed it, or was it just you just gradually kept working hard and you just saw yourself
getting... I started growing after 17, 18, I started to grow. So then I started adding some physicality to my skill set. By being small early on, you learn to use other people, you learn the tactical side, and two, technically, you have to be fairly solid. And that's something that I've carried with me throughout, and it's something I really enjoy talking about now and maybe teaching a bit. But so the physicality joined my skill set in that period. But I don't know. I mean, to me, and it remains so, it's all just paddling. If you're a good paddler, you know, you can move from surf ski to marathon to sprint to life-saving. The skill set is the same. Then you learn the specific skills to each discipline. But I think your mobility around the disciplines was easy back then. The Olympics wasn't quite so, I don't know how to be polite about it. But
be all and all?
Yeah, it was just another thing. Now, yeah, it gets increasingly sold to you like it's the thing.
Yeah.
And actually, way more enjoyment to have outside the Olympics than there is inside the Olympics. Yeah, the Olympics, I'm really glad I did it. It was one of my childhood aims to go to 3 Olympics, and I did that. I mean, I wasn't fast when I went to my first Olympics, don't get me wrong. I was probably one of the slowest in our team still. And because of the way the team was picked, that led me to end up with a K1 event, which normally the fastest guys would do. And it was quite a bizarre sort of, as all Olympic selections are, I think, quite a bizarre period where you go through that selection period and there's a lot of upset and a lot of skullduggery and there's a lot of, I don't know, other factors come in other than who's the best and who should be doing what. It ends up as who is going to do what and who's going to do what's left over. And two things there. I got to race the K1000, in which I was totally out of my depth. But the other thing was I first got to race with Grayson, Kayak Pro Grayson. And he was the best in our team. I was the worst in our team, and I was put in a K2 500 with him. So I'm properly out of my depth. Yeah. I'm going to let him down. And he toughed that out really, really well, I thought. And that was the start of our relationship that led to the medals in the next, in the subsequent 2 years. So,
yeah,
I think the Olympic thing, I went to because I wanted to. But with hindsight, I think I would happily have let that go for a bit of surf ski racing, to be fair. I think I would have got more out of it personally.
So you did, obviously, you went to your first Olympics, and it doesn't sound like you probably enjoyed it as much as maybe it's sort of put on.
I loved it. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, you loved it? Okay. Yes. Well, tell me what it was like.
Well, actually, I was quite young, quite naive at the time. And actually, being there, it was more like I was a spectator of the whole thing than a participant. So you kind of walk around the village with your eyes wide open. That's them. Yeah. I'm at the opening ceremony. I'm trying to take a photo looking back as we're leaving the stadium. I trod on some guy's foot. Turn around, and it's Carl Lewis. Yeah, shit, man. When do you meet Carl Lewis? Let alone tread on his toe, you know?
Yeah. Those sort of
incidents were really cool. And being part of an event like that was quite cool. I never felt like I was in it. I just felt like I was an observer and a spare part. Other people seem to be more in it. But yeah, there is no experience that's a bad experience. Yeah, I wouldn't hand those experiences back. I mean, each one I went to, you know, in Atlanta, which was my last one, it was a terrible experience because I was ill, as so many people are. The Olympic Village isn't like this village full of, you know, strong, healthy, fit people. It's like a war hospital. There's all the mental cases. You can imagine. As a viewer, you get shown the rostrum, don't you? Rah, rah, thinking shiny stuff everywhere. Everyone's happy. Everyone's loving it. Back in the village, everyone that's on that rostrum, there's 20 that have failed and they're crying into their soup in the restaurant there. There's ill people, sick people, people who haven't made it, people who are just horribly disappointed. It's a really bleak place, I think.
Yeah.
But still got a good vibe to it because you're all in it together and you're all in the same shit together. And actually a vast majority of you in world terms have failed, because the only thing that counts to the people who tell you the Olympics is worth going to, the only thing that counts to those people is a medal.
Yeah.
So the number of conversations I've had, because I'm an osteopath, so I treat the public and they talk to you and they chat to you, and sometimes your sport comes up. I never bring it up myself. It's a bit uncomfortable talking about it with them. But it turns out, oh, you went to the Olympics. And they're really excited. Yeah. Oh, okay. Did you win a medal? No. End of conversation. They don't know where to go now. What the fuck were you there for, you know?
It's a
medal or nothing. And then they try and come up with some sort of loose platitude where they go, oh, well, you know, it's really good be in there. And you've got no interest in it at all. And
it is a very interesting system, the Olympics. You've got that four-year block and you're going there and you're only set up to win a medal. And if you're not going to win a medal, it's kind of like pointless in a way. It's kind of what you're describing. But I've never actually heard the version of events that you've just described, like being at the Olympic Village and obviously there's a bunch of medal cases. But yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it, because there's only like a couple of winners in each race and the rest are all losers, essentially. Unless their goal was to make a final or something. But at the end of the day, they're not going to get much recognition from, I guess, their nation who sends them there if they're not winning medals.
Well, that's it. And increasingly, now the money comes in. Yeah, you started with the Olympics in Sydney. You started your massive funding project. We started our massive funding project shortly after that. And so because it's funded, the scoop, they widen their scoop so much to get the athletes in. But the actual funnel is so narrow at the bottom for success that 99% of people go through their sporting career having failed.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a shit way of going through your sporting career. You know, I've loved mine because I've had successes along the way. You've got a list of, like, on paper successes, Yeah. But there's so many other successes that you have that aren't headline successes, things that you've loved doing and things that you've got out of it. And, you know, I don't know, the Olympics is sold to us in a way that I think is disingenuous. I think it's, even the people who talk about it, the pundits who talk about it on TV, the people who talk, there's all those words, the words that come up, dedication, sacrifice, commitment, all those sort of glorious words. And I actually looked at your website and you mentioned sacrifice. I was disappointed in you, man. But there was no sacrifice to my sports career. I put it to you, there's no sacrifice to yours. There's no
Probably
sacrifice
not.
To you and training hard, because if you wanted to do something more than you wanted to do that, you'd go and do it.
Yeah.
So what are we sacrificing to go and play our sport?
Yeah.
We play it because we want to play it. And the idea that
totally right.
The idea that you somehow have to wade through knee-deep shit in order to succeed isn't true. You only succeed if you love what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you only love what you're doing if it's what you want to do. And you can only stay at it long enough to be the best if you've loved it and it's what you want to do. That's my take on it.
Well, my take on sport is pretty much exactly that as well. It's all about that holistic balance. It's like I get up every day and get to do the things that I want to do. Like there's not a thing that I wake up today like and go, I don't want to do that. And so if I don't want to do it, I just don't do it. I go like paddling. If I want to paddle, I paddle. If I don't want to paddle, I don't want to achieve those things, or I don't want to travel, or I don't want to talk to you on this booth because I'm not going to do it. And that's what I say to everybody. Like in my missus, like Christy, she's always like, oh, like, do you want to do this? I'm like, yeah. She's like, are you sure? I'm like, did I say? I was like, I don't have to. I said I'm going to do it, so I'm going to do it. Like, what? Like, there's no other thing we need to talk about, you know? Like, everything that I've been able to do with my sporting career has been good. And even when I was doing the kayaking stuff, I sort of had that, epiphany. Like, I was willing to sacrifice everything to do this kayaking thing. And basically, I sat down and got told that I wasn't in the coaches at the time's plan. So I went, got all my stuff and went and chased SUP and ocean ski. And I was like, it was the best decision I ever made. I was like, I wasn't going to spend another second wasting my time if it wasn't going to happen for me.
What you've done there, I think, which is the most important thing, is you've chased your goal.
Yeah.
Not the goal that somebody else has told you need to be chasing.
Yeah.
Why do you need to chase an Olympic goal when you could chase your goal?
Yeah.
And if you're chasing someone else's goal and you're looking for reassurance and feedback and positivity back from them, it's not going to happen, because it's got to be your goal. Otherwise, you haven't bought into it. And so, yeah, I mean, that when I look back on my sprinting, and I don't regret doing my sprinting at all. I had some fantastic times, and I enjoyed everything that I did.
Yeah,
but I think I'd still kind of bought into their goal, not my goal, which is why I never had the success I had in the things I'd bought into myself, because actually I didn't really believe it. I didn't really, chasing down that lane didn't have the magic for me. It didn't have, there was no puzzle to solve. There was no game to play.
Yeah.
It was just boom, go. And different things spark up different people. I see people get huge enjoyment from that. And in a way, I wish I could have had that level of enjoyment from it, but it didn't do it for me.
Yeah, I think it comes down to what you want in life and what your passions are. Like, my passions were probably never to do that, and to fall into a committed structure of like what I'm told I have to do and how I have to train and how I need to do this and this and this. It's like, there's all these other things that I want to do. Like, you need to justify to me. And it was never really justified to me in a way that I could understand. I think I couldn't sacrifice, as we've been talking about, to give it to that, because I was like, but I want to do all these other things. It's like, you need to make it appealing enough for me to want to stay. And it just never came. So I think I made the best decision for myself, and I'm very happy that I did, because I've had such an amazing career over the past like 5 years since I stopped it. So it's been really good for me. It's interesting that you've had that success and you've had the opposite opinion.
Yeah, and here we are years on, still involved with it, and you will be too. I mean, you're only young at the moment, but in 20 years' time, I can tell you, you'll still be interested in it. You might even still be doing these sort of podcasts. You'll be doing all that stuff because you love it. Because you, it's become who you are. And yeah, there's aspects of the canoeing that I hate, but
it's who you are. Yeah,
I'm still here because I love it as a thing. And there's directions things go in that I don't like, but what you're still there. And
we'll swing it back to obviously your successes. I see you get a silver in the 88 K2 marathon. But then you have your first win in 90. Can you tell us a little bit of a backstory around that? Because obviously you do the marathons for a few years, and then you do obviously get the gold medal in the 10K, and then you start winning your marathon titles after that.
Well, the marathon worlds only started in 88. So that first medal in 88 was day one for world championship marathons. It was in Nottingham. I don't know if
I've heard of it.
It's a godforsaken hellhole, about 2 hours north of London. And it was so windy that day. You're on a flat regatta lake, in theory. Yeah. We sank within 1,000 metres of the start. And the rescue boat was wrecked on the rocks at the end of the lake by the end of the day. It was just this chaotic, hideous day. And remember we were swimming. I had to watch the whole field come past so we could swim to the edge. My uncle was there, actually, the uncle who inspired me in the first place. And I said, mate, what do we do? He said, well, I'll give it up. He said, there's no point to this. And so we chatted for a little while, which is really bizarre thinking about it. Now we sat there and chatted for a little while. And he said, well, we'll go up to the end of the lake and back and see what happens. So we did that. First portage, we're 8 minutes behind now, the leaders. And all we've done is 1,500 metres, you know, or 2,000 metres or something. And luckily, the river was flowing. We moved from the Regatta Lake onto a really fast-flowing Trent River at the time. And that was one of our skill sets, reading the rivers and working upstream especially. So we come to the next portage. I had no idea where we were now. We'd overtaken a few people as far as I knew, but no real idea. And I said to my friend at the port, he said, well, where are we now? He goes, you're second. What do you mean with second? Well, you're second, he said. And I said, oh, shit. When we emptied the boat out for the second time, we dropped the buoyancy. We had to have a buoyancy block in the back of the boat to make it legal. I said, shit, you know, we've left the buoyancy halfway down the river there somewhere. We've got an illegal boat at this stage. This is probably secret. It's the best it doesn't go out to everybody, obviously.
Yeah. But, you
know. And I said to my mate, get us some buoyancy, because we're coming back to the same portage in about another hour's time. I said, get us some buoyancy. So we get back there, and he's got us this polystyrene 12 egg box, little box for 12 eggs, polystyrene thing, shoves it down the back of the boat. I think, that'll do. And we finished the race, came second behind the Danish crew, Tor Nielsen and Lars Kopp, who were just the best of the best. Actually finished with a couple of Australians. I think, you're testing me if you're asking me names, but Coulter and somebody maybe, Matt Coulter.
It was actually 3 years before I was born, so.
And, luckily the guy who was doing the boat testing was also the guy who sponsored us with the boat. So actually an egg box was perfectly adequate, it turned out, for buoyancy. And we got our medal there. Then we went to the Olympics. I ended up paddling with Grayson. And then because I genuinely felt I owed him, because I was so bad at the Olympics for him, for his level. I thought, you know what, I can do the driving of the 10Ks. And we decided to do the 10K and came second in 89, which was probably actually a better result than 90, bearing in mind our level and how the race went. And then the next year we were a little bit better again. And I thought, you know what? I went into that race thinking we could win it.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of things stand out on that one. Was kind of an illustration of how our coach worked. And he was my dad. He's an oddball. I mean, I don't ask anyone. He's not ordinary, But I remember we were getting in the boat. I thought, in my mind, I'm thinking, this is winnable. If I play it right, we can win this. And he hadn't come down to the water with us. And Grayson's in the back. Grayson did used to get a bit nervous. I hope he doesn't get offended by me saying that. He could be a little bit shaky sometimes on nerves. We're just about to push off from the side, and Roland, my dad, comes down. And his inspirational talk, which I'll never forget, he looked at us and he said, it's me, don't fuck it up. Yep. And that was it. And I just thought, well, actually, I hadn't really considered up to this stage fucking it up. But, you know, now that's a concept, you know, maybe I could do that. I don't know. But, and, yeah, it went well. And, yeah, there's the other thing that really stuck in my mind there, second or third was Fergusson McDonald from New Zealand. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
I think, is that the Ferg? Is it Ferg Kayaks in Auckland?
Yeah. So they were Olympic champions. Yeah, they were big time top of the tree guys. And a few years before that, probably 3 years before, at an event where I was still a junior in Denmark somewhere, I'd sat at a table with these big guys, and Paul McDonald, for some reason, I don't know why, he just started laying into me at the table. I'll never be any good. You're this, you're that. I'm thinking, I was just a little kid at the time, and he was the big cheese. I think I'm nearly in tears at the table. And I'm thinking, I want to leave, but I don't want to leave because I'm going to tough this out. I'm going to take this beating. And I remember that. I don't know. Maybe he'd been having a bad day, because I never experienced bad stuff from him after that or before that. But I do remember hating him for it. And then on that race in 90, we're coming up to the last turn, and I'd kind of got the impression we were the best by then, and they were really struggling, and they were on our inside at the turn. And he started begging me to leave him room on the inside of the turn. And I just thought, you know what? This is like proper payback now. I can choose whether you live or die here. Yeah. And I chose life for him, you know? And I thought, you know what? Have that. You know, and I know.
Yeah.
And so that was a big moment in my sporting career where I just thought, you know what? I owed you that. That was a payback moment.
You became the bigger man.
Those moments. So, yeah, I listened to Hank the other day. Yeah, so... Well, you don't realize when you watch someone else's career, and you see their results, you see their race, you see the result. But he had so many stories behind each of those events, didn't he? There was always a drama, there was background to it, there was story within the race. And as I'm listening to him, I'm thinking, shit, yeah, you know, every race you ever do, there's some sort of story behind it. And
yeah.
And yeah. You write your races down, and not one of them comes without a backstory.
And yeah, absolutely. And that's the interesting bit about like racing in general, in any paddle sport or sport in general, is that everyone just sees the result. No one ever hears about like what it took to get to that point. Because sometimes like all your chips are down, and then you pull it through at the end. But everyone just sees Hank McGregor wins Marathon K1, but there's like all this other shit going on in his life, and you're like. Hey.
It's worse than that. Hank McGregor wins K1 and people go, yeah, well, he would, wouldn't he?
Yeah. Like it's,
you can do it like that. Yeah, of course he won. He's Hank McGregor. And it, when you hear his stories, you think, oh, wow, you know, you have the same stories I have. Yeah. I have the same stories you have. We have the same fears, the same stresses,
yeah.
The same doubts, the same securities, insecurities. There's no magic to Hank McGregor. There's no magic to me. There's no magic to you.
Yeah.
We have the same outlook as other people. Generally.
And that's the idea of this podcast, I guess. It's just to talk to like all those different athletes out there who probably don't get their stories out there regularly. Like as you said before we went on, like you're like, I've never really spoken about myself before. And it's like, well,
yeah.
And that's the cool thing, because there's people out there who actually do want to hear your story and everyone else I've had on the podcast. Like there's like, and that's what people are loving about it, because yeah, like you see these results and you see these people, but you might have 5 minutes of their time very rarely. And then you never get like an hour and a half to sit down with someone and have a chat with them about like their life story. Like it just doesn't happen. So I thought this was a really good platform to be able to do it on. And I'm genuinely interested. I actually really like hearing the stories, because that's one of the reasons why I loved ocean ski so much in the first place, is because when I finished a race, I got to have beers and talk stories with like all of these older guys who've had all these like stories banked up for years. And I just pepper them with questions, because I'm just, I don't know, that's just why I am. And as you say, like it's a passion for me. But we'll talk about why did you think that your 89 result was better than your 90 result, despite you winning in 90?
I guess I've always grown up without winning being the goal. That was my dad's philosophy, I think. Yeah, just do, if you do the best you can do, that's good enough. And I had a really interesting discussion with Oscar the other day. On, he did it, one of his podcasts on big match mentality. So winning's never been a real goal. So playing the game to the best of your ability and doing your best. So we shouldn't have come second that year. I could probably think of five or six boats that probably should have beaten us, but we outperformed the result outperformed our ability. And also in a race like that, there's about 40 minutes worth of action going on all the time. And to get through 40 minutes without making a mistake is rare. And I don't think I made mistakes on that one at all. And we were lucky to come second. We could easily have come third in the end, but the Hungarians who won hated the Russians more than they hated us. So they squeezed the Russians out and we took second. Yeah. It's all fairly vague how those races finish in the end. From that day, the guy in the Hungarian K2 has just been one of my best friends ever since. He's godfather to my kids. And they're the relationships you build in through sport. And
Well, it's also, exactly. Like I was talking to Sean Rice the other day, and he was saying how, because like I feel like my best friends are like all around the world. Like they're everywhere. And like, we don't get to catch up that often, but when we do, it's like no time's being missed. And we're talking to him for a couple of hours the other day, and it was just like, it's really good to catch up. And we just don't get to do it that often because of our hectic schedules, and because we're usually all traveling around, or we got family or priorities or racing or whatever it is. But yeah, it's been really cool to meet so many great people in different paddle sports, and hopefully I can keep meeting them as we go. But 92, you win your first K1 marathon title. Can you walk us through that?
So I was supposed to race K2 there, and a couple of weeks before the event, my K2 partner pulled out. It was Olympic year, he'd raced at the Games. It'd been quite an emotional year for everyone, I think. So he pulled the plug, said, "I can't do it. I don't want to do it." Fortunately for me, one of the guys in the K1 who's said, "Wow, you need to do it instead of me. I'll go and do the K2. And that was just a gift for me. So really grateful for that opportunity. So flew out with my boat as hand luggage, 17 foot long in the hold of the plane, left it in Singapore airport overnight as left luggage. It was just a really surreal experience. Turned up to race, and it was a really long race there, 3.5 hours. There are only 2 hours now. So it was a big deal.
Yeah. And how many first, kilometers?
Too many.
Yeah, because it must have been like 40. It could have been 42.
It was supposed to be 42, which only ever took 3 hours, but their 42 somehow took 3.5.
Yeah.
So, just think a guy with elastic measuring tape or something. I don't know.
He just went, that'll do.
That'll do. And so I hadn't really prepared to race K1, but I'd obviously raced K1 plenty of times before, domestically and internationally at other events. And it was just, the big guns were there. It was a bizarre race. I remember Mike Mills Tom, who you probably know from your surf ski and stuff.
Yeah, I know Mike really well.
So he was one of the big names in that. He was... And racing at home, obviously, or at least home-ish. And he took a swim very early on, maybe in the first 5 minutes. And something obviously happened there, because two of us got away. It was myself and a Dutch guy. And the Dutch guy was all for, we got to go. This is it. You know, we're on for medals right here and now. And that was never really my mindset. I'm a bit of a loiterer. I don't really. And also you look at the game. The game isn't me and you going for a paddle together. The game is the race. So he was really egging me on and was getting really frustrated with me for not doing what he wanted. And I remember your mind does weird shit, doesn't it, sometimes? And I remember thinking, well, that's really odd, isn't it? Because I'm number 12 and he's number 21. We've both got a 1 and a 2 on our boats and we're first and second. I thought, what irrelevant thought that is. I just needed to fill the time before the race caught up.
And
so eventually everyone caught up. We had a race down to the bottom turn and back. And because it was so long, the whole race fell apart. It was a bit of a war of attrition. There were 10 of us, then there were 6 of us, then there were 3 of us after the last portage. Just three people. Myself, Stefan, who does the commentary with me now on the Marathon World still, and then Rui Cancio from Portugal. And it was just 3 of us. So you're thinking, well, that's kind of that sorted. And then the Portuguese guy fell off, so it's down to 2. And we literally had maybe 500 meters to go to the finish. And this was what's really bizarre about one of Hank's stories. Do you remember the one about where he had the boat come across? I think he was in one and the big waves. So exactly the same happened. I'm thinking that's surreal that we both had this same thing happen. This big sort of almost like army landing craft came across the river and the waves were sort of waist high. And in a K1, that's a little bit intimidating. But I saw my opportunity and I thought, boom, I'm on one of those waves. And it took a bit of doing to get there. And the waves going in my direction, the boat's going sort of 90 degrees to us. Stefan didn't take the plunge. And I literally just pulled away from him without another paddle stroke.
Yeah.
And it was game over. When the wave fizzled out, probably had 200 meters to go. And it's the most bizarre 200 meters I've ever paddled because I was so, you know, way far enough ahead that there was no question that I was going to finish first.
Yeah.
And so I had all this time for thinking and these doubts came into my mind and I started to wonder whether I could stay upright or cover. And all this like bizarre stuff. And I remember crossing the line and just thinking, Christ, thank God I actually made it over that last 200 meters. And
yeah,
it's a real thing. Just it seemed too easy, too good to be true. Something had to go wrong, I guess.
Oh, I had exactly the same thought process in ICF Worlds for the marathon, like the 18K race that they had in China last year. And I just gapped Bruno and Daniel. And I probably had like 50 meters on them. But I just, all of a sudden, I thought I was going to fall in. I thought I was going to make a mistake. I was like, just get to the fuck. I was like, and basically what you said before, I said, I told myself, just don't fuck it up. Like, what are you doing? Just get to the finish line.
Yeah. That's it. And where does all that come from? It's just that your brain has got, all of a sudden, it's been on fire, working out this whole race the whole time.
Yeah.
And then it's got nothing to do. Mm. And it just goes into some sort of meltdown. It was a very frightening experience, I thought. And
yeah.
But then the aftermath of that race, Stefan, who I just basically surfed away from, was proper angry.
Yeah.
And he was, and rightly so, and he was upset about it. You know, I hadn't broken any rules, so there's no chance of the result changing. But 2 weeks later, we raced again in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And very different race. And I remember he came up to me after that race. Because after Brisbane, after the Worlds, he'd said, you know, I could have won that, should have won, all these things. He was really emotional about it. And after Melbourne, 2 weeks later, he came up to me. And I'd beaten him again. I won that one as well. And he said, actually, I'm really sorry. I would never have beaten you 2 weeks ago. Yeah. And I was sort of super impressed that he saw it as he saw it. And
yeah,
actually said something to me about it.
That is a super hard situation as an athlete, though. I've had the same situations, and I've been on both sides of it. Like, sometimes things happen, and you can't control it, and you miss a boat wake, or someone gets one, or like there's something outside of everyone's control that happens. Yeah. Like, I remember Carolina Cup last year in the stand-up. Big, like, super yacht came through, and like a couple of guys like surfed them so well, and I just missed it. I didn't catch it, and they got me like 250 meters. And I was just like, oh well, I can't complain. I'm just gonna keep going, and I just ended up catching them and finishing the race and winning. But but then I've been on the other side of that where I've got the advantage and been able to paddle away, and obviously people are upset with you, and it's like, well, like what's like, what do I do? And then I've been on both sides. I've been upset and I've also been happy, and it's just like, yeah, you can't do anything about it. But it's good that that guy was like, yeah, like there's nothing you could do.
Yeah.
You have that win. That's your first one, but then you start winning. 94, 96, 98, you have wins and everything, K2 or K1. Can you talk us through those ones as well?
Yeah, so we came back from Australia in 92, and to me then I was a K1. I was going to be K1 racer. My other partner had retired, and I was just going to do K1. It was every other year back then in the world, so you had quite a lot of time in between. And then a new guy joined our club from another club, and my coach said, no, yeah, you need to paddle with him now for K2. So I'm back in K2. And there's a guy, Steve Harris, who I did 94 and 96 with. And we won both those. And the reason for doing that was then two of us got Grant, not one of us.
Yeah.
So kind of, it's just logical to do it. And as much as I wish I'd had the opportunity to race more K1 races at that stage, that it was the thing to do. And actually, it was hysterical fun racing with him, because he's mad as a fucking badger. And really entertaining. It's like trying to manage a puppy that's still at the pissing on the floor stage when he gets excited. And he was just a great, fun guy to be with, to train with, to have around. He's a liability in every aspect, but just it was a really good period, actually. And, good fun. But what was really entertaining in that period was that, whereas I'd grown up without winning being a target, and you know, my dad was always of the mindset that if you could win a race, it probably wasn't worth entering in the first place. You probably should have entered a different race that you could have got more out of than winning.
Yeah.
So winning was almost frowned upon, but Steve had come from a different background. Winning was everything. And it didn't matter if you were beating an asthmatic pygmy, provided you beat him.
Yeah.
That was, you know, boom, have that.
Yeah.
And so winning was everything for Steve. And we raced in 94, and we were pretty good. And you know, on those years when you're pretty good, you just think, you know what, we're quite good now. And we raced around, it was in Amsterdam, the Worlds. And so the coaches could all cycle around, because it's around the canals and they've all got the paths around. So the coaches cycle around with us. They're more coaches than paddlers. So they saw everything. And we won the race, which didn't really have any downsides to it. And we're paddling across to where you get your boats weighed at the end, and our coach is there, Roland's there. And Steve, in the back of the boat is vibrating. It's literally humming. He's that excited that the whole boat is shaking away. And as we're approaching the landing stage, he's like, Roland, Roland, Roland. He's going, what do you think? What do you think? And he just wanted this praise to come back on him, that he's world champion. This is the pinnacle of his life up to this point. And our coach goes, yeah, he says, it was a bit boring. And that's it. And it's like someone sticked a pin in Steve in the back of the boat, a pin in a balloon. It was just boof. And it just grasped that he'd won the world championships, and his coach thought it was boring. And what he meant was, you know what, you should have won. You did win. Nothing went wrong. There's no adversity to overcome. And he was bored by it. But partly it was the relationship between Roland and Steve, who had such different backgrounds, that was so entertaining through that period.
Yeah, that's quite cool. And then you won again in 96.
Won again in 96.
Was it more exciting this time?
96, no. It was actually, because I wasn't well in 96. So we had to race in a different way. So, yeah, we had to race a bit more conservatively. We had a bit of an upset at the start as well because people went inside a buoy and we had to go back round and a bit more palaver. So, yeah, it was a little bit more exciting. But then after that, I think you've probably seen people do the same. Steve then became world champion. And he started training and behaving like he was world champion. And that meant he didn't have to do everything because he was world champion. And actually, I'm a strong believer that you race like you're the world champion, but you train like you're not. Because if you start believing you're world champion on a daily basis and you're the best there is and the best there can be, kind of, it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
So he started doing less and less. And, you know, and we had as you do in doubles, it's a bit like a marriage. You have a falling out at some stage. I said, you know what? No, I'm done now. I have to go and race K1. And next race in K1 was 98. Yeah.
It's South funny Africa. How that complacency sets in. You actually say it well, like you should train like you're not a world champion, even if you are, because like, yes, there's always those guys who are just like banging down the door to try and beat you. And that's their goal. And if you just think, if you go into a race, and I've made that mistake before thinking that I was going to win again and I get smoked or I finished like all over the place. It was just, I've learned that really the hard way to make sure that I always train hard and just make sure that I can put my best performance on the day rather than trying to pretend that some old victory or like something like that is going to be able to somehow reproduce itself without you doing any hard work. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's it. Like it will happen by magic, and it doesn't really happen like magic. But I was really lucky with my training group. We had such a good training group through that period that actually I wasn't the best in the training group. So that kept you honest. Yeah, if you wanted to be the best consistently in our training group, I think you'd have had to be pretty special. Pretty much like Hank described getting in the South African marathon team, you had to be a world medalist.
Yeah.
Our training group was full of world medalists at that stage. So, and on a day-to-day training basis, I wasn't the best. So
it was, but you're better, yeah. You're obviously a better racer then.
Yeah, racer. I love the racing. I love them. Well, 10K ideally, but marathon was a close substitute. I just love managing all that that's happening. Get that vision going, get the thought processes going. There's so much brain activity goes on with that where you're weighing up who's who, what their personalities are. It's like playing a live game of Top Trumps, isn't it? When you race people. So you've got their attributes. You know what they're good at, what they're bad at. You know who they are, and you've got your handful of top trumps, and you think, right, what can I do to him? What can he do to me? What can they do? Who do I not need? And I'd never thought of it like that before, but yeah, so it is a game of top trumps.
Well, totally. Like I look at it exactly like that. I know when I first came into something like stand up, I didn't really know anybody. So I just played my tactics, but then you start to learn your competitors. You start to learn who you can attack, who you can't attack, who you can attack in certain situations, like who's going to be around in certain stages of the race. If they're not there. You have like 1,000 different plans in your mind, but you never know which one you're going to use because you don't know who's going to be around you. And I just love that. I love being in like pack situations where you're trying to hurt people. You're trying to go easy or go hard. You're just playing so many different mind games. It makes it more fun than paddling straight down the line and not really attacking.
That is the game, isn't it? That's the game you're playing. And that's what, it frustrates me when you're talking to other people and I get involved with doing a bit of coaching here or there and somebody says to me something as basic as, well, what average speed do I need to win a marathon world championship? I don't know. There is no average speed. You have to have a full box of tools and you need to call out those tools in the right order at the right time.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to do. There's no average speed, and it's sometimes mind-numbing when you talk to people, even people that have been in it for a long time. You think, well, you really haven't grasped what we're trying to do here, and you'll have them in your sport. I describe them as the donkey. You know that if you get left behind, there is Donkey Boy back there who will just be consistent. He'll drag you back up to the front, at which point you can say, hop off his, go, thanks a lot, Donkey Boy. I'll go and join the real race now. And it's like, those people are out there, and their solution is to get a little bit fitter for next year so they can be a slightly higher grade donkey. But they remain the donkey, and yeah, year in, year out. And it's sad to watch it. So I'd love, you know, when I coach, do work with the kids that I work with, I try and get that into them. I try and educate. I'm not sure how well you can actually share that knowledge. You can give it out, but it has to be understood, and that's the bigger part of the equation probably.
Yeah, a lot of people do follow that like average speed thing. I've got to be paddling this fast or that fast. And it's like, do ya? Because like if that guy's paddling, I don't know, on a stand up, they're paddling like a 10 k's an hour, and that's, I'll just sit on him. I don't need to paddle. He's going to keep attacking me every time I paddle. I don't need to do that. He can do that. And then I'll just paddle when I need to paddle or whatever it is. And like, that's the game. And that thing's so hard to teach. And obviously the mental side is so hard to teach as well. Like I know a lot of people that I work with, it's the physicality is easy because training is easy. Really, when you break it down, like you just go out and you train, you do this and you get fitter and you get faster.
Yeah.
But teaching tactics and teaching like the mental side of racing is something that I'm trying to grasp because I'm trying to put it in ways that people understand, but it's bigger than sometimes, I guess, on the physical side of things.
I think so. And for all the wins I had, I was never the fittest in that race. I was never the strongest in that race. I never had the best VO2 max. I never had the best blood lactate profiles. I would never have had the best single tool ever in any of the races I ever won. But if you use them right, you're okay.
And yeah,
I think that's the joy, I think, of the distance racing or 10Ks and the marathons and the surf ski. There's such a wide skill set that you don't have to be the biggest monkey to win the race. And I think that opens it out to people. It opens it out to anyone if they're prepared to go through the learning process.
Yeah, absolutely. And you obviously stepped out. So you stepped out with Steve in 96 and you started to go back to K1. You win 98 and then the world championships must have come to every year. Then you won every 99 year. As well. Yeah. Were those, because they were like your last two wins, were they special moments for you?
98 was special because all through my career, when we first started, the people who won in 88 were the Danish, Tor Nielsen and Lars Kopp. To me, we never really beat them. We had an opportunity to beat them in 1990 when they broke their rudder, but that's a different story.
Yeah.
But so I'd never actually beaten either of those. But then Tor Nielsen is doing K1 in 98 in South Africa, and it's strange how you see a race. So the entire race for me was me against him. That was it. The other people were there, but they're kind of peripheral spare part players in the process. And it was really, I don't know, yeah, you look up to someone for that long and then going towards the last turn, so about, you know, 1500 meters to the finish, there are four of us in the group. It was him and me, Dolph Tillin from Holland and Norwegian guy, Torgeir Toppe. And the four of us were there. We're going towards the last turn and Tor went for it. He attacks. And I went for it, and we both knew we were side by side for way too long, and we both knew that whoever won that was going to win the race, and that was it. That was the race. But it wasn't just that 300 meters. It wasn't just that 3 hours. This was me against him to decide at that stage who was top dog,
yeah.
And it was such a meaningful thing. And we both went flat out. In the end, I won that race at that stage. And we looked back, and the other two were so far behind. Christ knows how long we've been going for. And we both just put our paddles down pretty much and waited for them. And then the race started again, and we went to the actual finish, which was a little bit of a fizzle out in comparison to what had just happened.
Yeah.
And at that stage, because you've beaten someone that you've looked up to forever, I think then and it was my K1, proper K1 win.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, I'm good now. Yeah. That puts me in with the right people. And yeah.
But what changed from you, obviously, as a youngster and obviously going through, and your dad was always like, you just need to go out and do your best and winning doesn't count, to getting to that race and going, I need to win this. I need to prove myself. I need to be one of the best. Like, what changed? Because that's a very different approach to what you told me maybe half an hour ago when you were talking about different stories.
I don't think so. I don't think it is. But I think as you get better and better, so your position in the race, in the world, in whatever, improves. So winning's still only a side effect of managing that race to an extent where I could take on somebody of that quality and beat them. So that is just a management job until it actually happens. Then you have to deal with the inevitable pain and discomfort of those head-to-heads where we've all been in them. You think, I hope he fucking stops soon because this isn't sustainable. And
yeah,
and it's how well you deal with that. And that's what I've learned over the time is managing that unpleasantness that you have to experience. And
yeah,
and so there it was managing that unpleasantness. That pain comes in, and instead of thinking, I don't like this, you know, it's uncomfortable, I need to back away from it. There, I think my biggest thing was that I got to that real stage of being good where the pain comes and you welcome it in. And you go, you know what? If I'm hurting this much, I'm going bloody fast now. And if anyone else is going to beat me, they have to be experiencing this also.
Yeah.
And I'm loving it. And they can't be loving this more than I'm loving it. So game on.
Yeah, you got to love the pain.
I don't think it was to win. It was to achieve. And in order to achieve on that race, I had to beat Tor. And if I beat Tor, then I happened to win. So don't get me wrong. I love the winning. But I do think winning's overrated as a thing, and being world champion is overrated. Winning your world championships, I don't think is any more exciting than winning your under 12s. When you're under 12, that's equally exciting. All that changes, I think, is that the external perception of your win is much greater.
Yeah.
So you get a lot more external credit for your win at world champion than you do at under 12. But actually, the feeling of coming across the line and winning is exactly the same. That never changes, I don't think. And I think that's where, in a lot of ways, I started to go wrong, is you start desiring the external praise and you forget about your internal and what actually genuinely brings you joy. And then you've substituted internal for external validation and it's not sustainable anymore.
Yeah.
It just disappears. It kind of just vanishes into the ether because the external is, you know,
I think you've got a really good approach to that. And I can see you won a Fair Play Award in 1990. I think you stopped or something like that because somebody else broke the rider or something like that.
That was the last tour in the K2, yeah.
Yeah.
So again, it was another race where, in my mind, it was us versus them with the other people playing a background role. Hmm. And they came over a portage and I could see, you know, we're with them and they're kind of struggling. I'm like, guys, what's up? You know, we can't steer, the rudder's bent up and we're stuck on the bottom of the boat. And well, you know, if you're prepared to let me bend it down with the risk of snapping it off, I'll do it.
Yeah.
So we stopped and we bent their rudder down, didn't snap off, and then the bastards went and beat us. And yeah, come on. But I mean, I don't know. It wasn't any sort of noble thought process. It wasn't I should do the right thing. It just, my game had ended there. It's like you're in the middle of a video game and the power cut goes on.
Yeah.
I hadn't finished that game yet. I want to finish that game. and that's how it was. I just thought, no, we can't stop it here. We've got another hour to go, and I wanted that extra hour of fun. And
So did you retire from kayaking, or did you just stop competing at an international level in 1999, or was it you kept racing after that?
99 was my last good one, and I wish I'd never gone. It was a big mistake to have gone. I was unwell at the time. My team convinced me that I should just go and watch. So we left for Hungary, and my plan was to watch it. And then we got there, and, you might as well start. And then, it just all built up to this me being in the race that I didn't really want to be in. I don't even remember what's wrong. Some sort of chest infection type background.
Like bronchitis or something like that.
I wasn't well. And anyway, we started, and your brain leads your body at that stage, and you put yourself where you need to be, and the race gradually unfolds. And then I remember the last portage, the two guys got away, Hungarian and the Dutch guy. And I just thought, it's down 1500 meters maybe to the finish. I'm six, seven lengths behind. Third will do, I'm really not fast. I don't care. And they stopped. They stopped and waited. And because that was their expectation. They knew I should be there, and I wasn't there, and they expected me to be there. And it was just a surreal thing. So I caught them up, and they let me lead. And I thought, well, guys, it's over, isn't it? You've let me lead, and that's how it works. And so it was quite a tough race to the finish, and I finished. And at the moment I finished, I thought, I've overcooked this. Everything in me. I went into a team tent. I laid down. I was crying. I'd done too much, and I knew from that point on I would never train hard again. I would never race hard again.
Yeah.
I could hear everything in me saying, no, not again. That's it. And I didn't think about it at the time. It wasn't. I wasn't aware that it was hurting me that much at the time. But the moment I stopped, just thought, wow, that was kind of stupid. It was stupid. Yeah, it was a crazy thing to do. Actually, that's the first race I ever raced. Hank, he raced that. It was his first Worlds.
Yeah.
And essentially my last one. And just very, very bizarre. So, I'd gone off sort of like an old Labrador, if you like, and he'd come in as a little puppy. So excited, he's pissing on the floor everywhere in the group, running into it on paddles, and everything in me just going, for fuck's sake, I just want this to be calm.
Yeah.
And he tells a story of that I don't actually believe, because I can't believe I said what I said to him. But
what did he say to you?
Well, he was like, he's causing chaos in this group, absolute chaos, and I just needed calm. And he says, and he said it at one of the World Paddle Awards speeches, that I said to him, do you know who I am? I think that is the single most offensive thing that anyone can say. I just find that the most noxious sentence. If anyone ever said that to me, I just think, who the fuck? And so I genuinely, in my heart of hearts, I said to him, I didn't. I would never have said that. And he's sure I did. I'm sure I didn't. Yeah. I can imagine saying maybe something like, mate, you got to understand how this works, because you're just, it's like having a fucking dodgem car in the middle of a track race, And if I did say that to him, I would love to make a public apology. And I would hope in my
heart. No, don't apologize for it. I think that's hilarious that you said that to him.
I hope I never said anything that offensive to anyone. I genuinely do. That brings shame on the family.
So just to confirm, you definitely said that to Hank, right?
He says I did. So I say I didn't. I guess in that scenario, I've got a reason to lie, and he hasn't. So
yeah. Yeah,
no, I don't,
He's a very good storyteller, so I'm sure there's some sort of truth to it, but there could be a little bit extra added in.
Yeah, I hope there's a bit of icing on that truth somewhere. But it was cool.
So you wrapped up basically your competitive career in 99. You went in, you got an MBE for your services canoeing in 2000. You've started up. I know you do a lot of coaching. You're doing a lot of different stuff, obviously, after canoeing. I know you're a surf ski paddler as well now. How is life after the canoe days?
It's there's stuff I miss and there's stuff I still wish I could do, and it's different. If I could go back and do it again, I would go back and do it again 100%. But there's also a part of you that thinks kind of done with being that person and having those sort of drives, no sort of needs to constantly reaffirm yourself to yourself. So the surf ski was brilliant for me because I went, I'm a half decent paddler and a terrible surf skier. So immediately competition is stripped away from you. It's just you and what you can get out of it. And that was fantastic for me. And so I could enjoy doing it again rather than relying on enjoying being good at it. And so that was a real like breath of fresh air and almost a bit of life support for me through that period. Gradually life's overtaken me, kids, jobs, daddy, all the usuals. And I don't compete. I don't even paddle that much at all anymore. But I genuinely wish I'd found surf ski sooner. I mean, it's just not an English thing, you know. So little of it here. It's grown quite a bit in the last few years, but before in my period, it wasn't there. You get on with life, you substitute other stuff. It's not the same. But I don't want to be. Yeah, I have this genuine fear of getting fit. So in this lockdown, I got my paddling machine out. You know, yeah, handful of blisters to show for it, and you think, well, I'll go for a run. I'll do these things. I have a genuine fear that if I get fit again, I'll start to get an eye on the prize. And you think, you know, if I do that, do I want to go down that route or not? I don't really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm quite happy living it through other people at the moment. I know Tim messaged you earlier today, working with Tim.
Yeah.
Some large new guys aiming for the Olympics. And to have that sort of ambition for someone else is a sort of an outlet for it, and
yeah,
that's been a really positive relationship. Just working with someone, and obviously the kids that I coach at my canoe club, they're great, and you can love it for them now, and it's a substitute of sorts.
It is quite cool, and I've actually found that as well. Like even now that I'm still racing, I'm able to coach people and sort of help them achieve their goals. It's kind of like, you can see it sort of being that outlet, because when they do well, you do well. And when they don't do well, you feel like you've let them down. So it's like, it's the same mentality, really. You're just using someone else as a vehicle for your own competitiveness.
It's bad.
Isn't it?
Is that bad? Are we bad people for doing that?
I don't know.
You want them to succeed for their sake, but there is an element of it that wants to succeed for my sake. It's not quite that strong,
but I think it's kind of, in a way, selfish, but you are helping someone else. But when it is like they're a vehicle for you, in a way that they may not be able to achieve what they can achieve without you helping them along the way. So it's kind of like a selfish relationship. Each was when you go to a coach, you're asking them to teach you how to be better. And I've been able to do that from so many different coaches. Now it's like, how can I give that back?
But yeah, coaching's been a real experience. I mean, for Tim and myself, it's most definitely been mutually beneficial. You know, he's taught me a lot. He's come from a fairly dark place in some ways, mental health wise. He's had his issues in the past in corporate world, and he's taken on his sport. He did canoeing before he got into his work life. Now he's come back to it, and we've all got our background issues. And to almost help him work through his helps me work through mine.
Yeah.
And they're different to his, but you know what? By giving advice, half the time you're giving the advice to yourself, even though you're giving it out to somebody else, and to see the positive change that's given to him and to me as a mutually beneficial unit is really cool. And the same for the kids you coach. You know, you see them grow from your confidence, but actually, well, they don't realize, they think they're growing from your confidence, but they're actually gaining their own confidence. All motivation has to be internal, really. External is very short-lived, isn't it? You know,
the way you're talking about, like, obviously the best way to learn is to teach somebody else, and that's something that I've always been able to sort of appreciate, because I know when I teach someone else, I'm like, oh, I should have thought of that before. Now I'm saying it because now I understand it more because I'm telling you what to do. Because, and then you have those questions that people throw at you and you're like, well, that's just what I do. And then you have to like work out how to explain it to somebody else. So then you 100%. Learn better for yourself. It's quite an interesting, situation.
Yeah. My lead into coaching was one guy who came to me, Ben Brown. I don't know, you may have heard of him, you may not. So he came to me. I'd known him since he was a kid. He's at my club. He'd known me as being one of the better paddlers. And he came to me and said, can you help me? And he's already junior world champion at this stage. And he's now senior. So I'm like, yeah, bring it on, you know. What can't I do? So we went out paddling. I said, look, can you change this? Can you do that? And boom, he'd change this and he'd do that. And I said, right, now we'll do this. And he'd do this and he'd change this and he'd change that. And I thought, and then he's senior world champion. All right, mate, I'm fucking good at this. I'm the best coach in the world, one from one. I've coached one person, they're world champion. I'm pretty much God's gift to this lot, you know? And so... I went and took on a group of kids at my canoe club, and I took the same approach. They're doing something wrong. I tell them to do it right, and they continue to do it wrong. But I told you to do it right, and you're still doing it wrong. I've told you 10 times. I've even told you louder now. I've even shouted the same instruction at you, and you're still doing it wrong. Yeah. Are they retarded? Are they deaf? What is wrong with them? And you just think, and then I realized, and that one of the kids came up to me, a little bit quivery bottom lip, and said, well, yeah, I am trying. Mm. And I thought, oh, holy shit, you know. I realized with Ben and with me and probably with you as well and a lot of the other people you've spoken to, I would describe as physically literate. Mm. So if I tell you to do something, your computer, you can feel it, which is the real key. You can feel what difference it makes. And I ask you to do it, you get better, and on we go.
Yeah.
But I realized I had actually zero coaching skills. I had zero alternative languages to use. And I actually didn't know what I was teaching. Yeah. So exactly like you. Yeah, I went away and I started paddling on my own again and thinking, well, how do I do this?
Yeah.
Well, it's nothing like I was telling Ben, but Ben could translate it into reality, whereas the other kids couldn't. And so, yeah, then you start learning what it is like, and you try and teach. And there's a video out there of me coaching, which is kind of where I got to at that stage in my perception of what technique was and how it could be taught. And, you know, some people like it. I'm sure there's some people who don't, but it's... I don't know, coaching, that's hard, isn't it?
It's hard because there's so many different ways of paddling, and you've only really got your perception of how you think people should paddle or you think you should paddle, but it may not necessarily work for every single person you coach. And then what you're telling them will translate into something not exactly the same, but something that works for them. But they think that they're doing the wrong thing because it doesn't look exactly like, say, you might look. And it's really sometimes quite difficult to explain that to someone. It's like there is so many different ways of paddling out there, and you might have 50 different coaches you read from, but 1, 2, 3 of them, and you'll pick pieces of what they say that will make you a better paddler. No one's like 100% the expert.
And even if the information you're given is good, what you tell them is not what they hear. And that's really hard because they'll come back to you a month later and go, I've been doing everything you said and now I'm doing this. And you think, ooh, what, What exactly was it I told you to do? Because that doesn't resemble anything that I think I would have told you to do. And they repeat back to you what you said. I think, wow, you clearly understood that in a way that was never meant to be. And
yeah,
it's really interesting. And it's, I don't know. Yeah, I think there are principles of paddling that you can lock down, but how people interpret that is down to them. And you know, even an Olympic final, you have nine lanes, nine different people paddling nine different ways. And
yeah, and that's all, and that's sometimes the really hard thing to talk to people about is when like you see an Olympic final, like for something like that, for kayaking, and then you see all those different techniques, and then people look at that and they go, oh, this is what I should be doing for surf ski. Like I don't know, Tim Brabham's paddles like this, or Anders Gustafsson paddles like this. Like, I should paddle like that. Yeah. It's like, well, out of Vancouver, and like, no, but you're not paddling the same craft. You're paddling a surf ski. So like, it's going to be slightly different to that. And they're like, oh, well, Corey Hill paddles like this. I should paddle like Corey Hill. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't have the same physique or the arm span of Corey Hill. You should be paddling like, I don't know, Macca Heinart or Jasper Mokka. Like you've got to, horses for courses, really, you know?
So many variations. It's unreal. And I don't know. And then there's magic on top of that, isn't there? Yeah. There's science and there's magic. And you can do all the science you like. You can do all the filming. You can do all the monitoring. You can do all the physiological testing. But there's still magic. And or art, if you want to call it art. I don't know how to think about it. But some people can do it and some people can't. And
it's all about that computer up there, isn't it?
I think it is. It's, you know, the constant search. If your brain stops searching for a better feel, then you're dead in the water, I think. You just got to keep searching for a better feel. Strength isn't the answer. Fitness isn't the answer. You can't just make yourself stronger to cover that next deficit because, you know, there's always someone stronger than you, isn't there? It doesn't matter how strong you are. There's still going to be someone stronger.
Yeah, and you've got to work out what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, and really make that into the paddler that you want to be. And it comes down to that hard work and determination if you want to achieve that goal. And if you don't really want to achieve it, you can achieve it part of the way or half the way or whatever it is. Like, that's all the decisions that actually the individual has to make, because I guess that it's that old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And it sort of really comes down to that most of the time.
Yeah, and I think... Yeah, we talk about goals an awful lot, and I do believe you have to have a goal, but you also have to value and enjoy the journey as much as you would value and enjoy the goal, because otherwise they don't tally. You can't get to a magical goal if you're not valuing the journey and the things you learn along the way, the people you meet along the way, the experiences you have along the way. If the rug's pulled out from under you, which it has been for so many with the Olympics this year and all the other competitions this year, if your heart was only set on the goal, now you're devastated. But actually, if you look back and go, you know what, the last year's training, I've met these people, I've had this much fun, I've travelled to these places, I've grown this much as a person. So all that's in the bank. That stuff never leaves. That never leaves. You can't spend those savings. They're savings for life. Whereas the result is... possible, maybe it's not, you never know. Results sort of a nefarious thing, but the journey is set in stone. And if you can nail that journey, which we were lucky enough to do simply because of the group of guys we had around us at the time, I just think it's such a sport. It's so cool. Yeah, you do it or you don't do it. Nothing frustrates me more than these people who sit around who didn't actually go and commit to it and do it to the best of their ability, who sit in the pub and talk about the could-haves, should-haves and would-haves.
Yeah.
And sport isn't about could-have, should-have or would-have. It's simple. It's about did or didn't. And you either did or you didn't. And there's no middle ground. And there's, you get these conversations, oh, do you think he could have beaten him? Do you think he should have beaten you? All this, who do you think's the best ever? Kind of sits that. I just, you're the best ever. I'm the best ever. Hank's the best ever. Oscar's the best ever. We're all the best ever.
I'm the best Michael Booth ever. That's it. That's what I keep telling myself.
You're the best ever.
But the important thing as well is like you're talking about the journey so much. It is really about the journey. I remember saying this to Christy the other day, my partner. I was like, we have had like the best like last 4 years of our lives. Like we never didn't do anything. We went on holidays. Like we went and saw friends and family. Like we got to race. We got to see amazing places. I was lucky to have success as well. And it was just like, if we did all of it again, and like we like in this situation right now with COVID-19, where everything's been shut down, it's kind of like, yeah, like it's awesome. I had like such an amazing 4 years, and like if yeah. everything stops now, then that's okay. I can move on to something else because I did really enjoy everything that I did.
Yeah, and if you're not enjoying everything you're doing, change it.
Yeah,
change it. Just get out. You know, you can't. You know, it almost brings you back to the Olympic thing. You can't live somebody's Olympic dream and go for an Olympic gold if it's not making you happy on the journey to it, it won't. A, you won't get there anyway, but B, even the Olympic medal won't make you happy because you'll still look back on the 4 years that you've just talked about and go, phew, that's a bit shit, wasn't it? I'm glad we're through that. Yeah. Why would you want to do that?
Absolutely.
There is no earthly reason why, you know. And I get really agitated at home because Olympics is everything in our canoeing world at the moment. And, yeah, 99.999 forever and ever percent of people will fail to win an Olympic medal. See, with Olympic medal as your goal, well, good luck to you, mate. You're going to fail. To be a world champion, you're going to fail. The probability is you're going to fail. How many people succeed? Yeah, Hank's won for the last 10 years. Well, that means 9 other people haven't won, doesn't it?
Always different people who like have the same goals, and you have to get out there and you have to take it. And you have to enjoy the whole process. Otherwise, the whole thing is going to be a failure. And you're just going to be like, what did I do that for?
And as much as you can admire your Hanks and people like that who win year in, year out, I love the chancers who come along and do one. Mm. Just because it was their day. They took the opportunity on that day, whether Hank's sick, whether he's not there, whatever it is, boom. Somebody's turned up and the opportunity's there and they have just like rabbit up the drain pipe. They've gone, boom, I'll have it. It's one off. You know, in the marathon, Chad Meek did it in 96. You know, he won once. He was always there or thereabouts, but boom, he won his world championships. And he will always have that. And there's always those, they're not chancers because they're bloody good athletes. You know that. You can't come from nowhere to win. But yeah, I think opportunity, to have opportunity and to take opportunity, that's magic, and that's what you hang in there for, isn't it? It might just pop up one day for you.
Yeah, you've got to be in the fight to win the fight, and if you're not there, you're not ready to take that opportunity when it presents itself, and you're never going to be able to take it. You're probably going to regret it forever. So yeah, that's what I always say. I'm just like, just got to chase those opportunities as they get presented to you. In any of the races, there's like 100 different opportunities you can take, and you've just got to take one of them at the right time, and it's going to work for you. But with COVID-19 at the moment, obviously, as we're just saying, like everything's sort of been shut down, no events, like Olympics postponed, no surf ski races, nothing. I don't know when it's going to like change. Like there's no real future planning. It's just all chaos really at the moment. How are you dealing with that, and how are you helping your athletes through this period as well?
Actually, I'm not helping them at the moment. My best two juniors, They're obviously at home. They've got their ergs. They've got opportunity. They've got a little. They can do their press ups. They can do their body weight stuff. They've got a little bit of weights at home.
Yeah.
And it's the first time they've been left to self motivate and self govern and do it by themselves. And they've actually run with it. And they're doing really well. So I've stepped away, and they're all the time until they cry for help. They're on their own pretty much. And it's been really cool watching those two kids go, you know what, we're in, and we're going to commit to it, and they've taken responsibility for their own motivation and their own training for the first time. And that's been superb. So I'm absolutely doing fuck all with them. They're on their own, doing their own thing, and that's how it will be until they ask for some help.
Yeah, that's really important as well. Like them actually learning their own way and actually just going, well, actually, I do want to do this. I'm not doing it because of any external reason. I'm doing it because I want to do it. And this is a perfect time to show that.
Yeah. And Tim, the paracanoeist, he's just come back from probably his best training ever. He's been out in Australia for quite a lot of the winter. And, you know, it was looking really exciting because it looked like he's just outside the Olympic team in the UK at the moment. But it was looking very much like we're there. You know, this is going to be right there. He's come back. He's all fired up. Boom, COVID hits. And he's relaxing. He's resting. Olympics is off for this year. Maybe on next year. That's a long time away. He's enjoying relaxing. And he has used that time to look inwards and take a look at his journey. And you know, this time a year ago, he was questioning not just his canoeing, but everything. He was in a pretty low spot. I don't think he'd mind me telling you he's in a low spot. And questioning, you know, your meaning of life type stuff. And and now he's looking back on a journey that's been pretty cool, really. Sending me photos of sunrises, and I don't know, he's got into his meditation through a whole series of coincidences, accidents, injuries, and said so many ups and downs, but he's at a place now where he's looking back and enjoying life. And in that respect, you know, my little part of his journey has been so thoroughly rewarding. And that's where my main athletes are at the moment. They're living the dream, really, I would say. It's cool. I do worry a bit about, you know, at what point, nobody knows what point it's going to end, do they?
No.
How long is all that sustainable for? How long can you do that sort of enthusiasm? I know I've got a horribly short attention span. So without a race on the horizon for me, and that horizon was usually 1 week away, then I'd start, my brain would wander and start firing off in all sorts of random directions. I don't think I would cope with it well if it was my turn, but
yeah,
luckily not.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there anything you wanted to add before we wrap this up? Is there any like sort of advice you'd give to any of the paddlers out there who are trying to get better, or is there any advice there for people to get through this COVID situation? Like, is there anything you wanted to add before we jumped off?
I think we've covered it. I think the only thing you do is you chase your own goal, and that goal has to be yours. You have to own the goal. You have to own the motivation to do it. There's so much science and stuff around at the moment because that's what we've learned and we've got access to. There's so much input to you saying to you that there's a right and a wrong way of doing things. And then the kids and people start to get fearful that they're not doing it in the right way, in which case they're doing it in the wrong way and they can't be successful. And that's just not true. There's your way. And I think if you believe in your goal, you've got your goal, there can be no negative outcome. Because you'll either enjoy the journey, you'll reach the goal, or you'll go as far down that route as you can, and put your faith in you, not in some sports psychologist or a scientist or anything. You use those people where they're appropriate, and they are appropriate in places, but the belief is yours. And they have fun, man. It's supposed to be fun. Like we said early on, you don't have to wade through knee-deep shit to get to a worthy goal. If you're wading through knee-deep shit, you've taken the wrong turn.
Yeah, no, I can completely agree with that. And I think it's all about, yeah, just following your passions, having love for what you do and investing in yourself. I know for myself that my biggest follow throughs or biggest achievements have been when I've just like doubled down on myself and just gone, no, I think I can do this. I'm going to do it. And I don't care what other people say or whatever external thing is happening around me. I'm just like, I think I can do it. I'm just going to do it. And if I fail, at least I know that there's no sitting in the pub in 40 years or whatever going, oh, I should have done this and I wish I did this. And it's like, I've done everything that I've always wanted to do. Like I quit engineering at like 19 because I was like, I'd rather be a poor athlete. And then I like did surf ski for a bit and I was like, I'll give the Ironman for a little bit. And I was like, I gave surf ski a go and I did kiking and get better at that. And I got pretty good at kiking and I was like, I can see SUP might be better. So I did SUP and I was like, at no point did I not just do stuff. And that's my biggest advice, is just get out there and have a crack. And even if someone says you shouldn't be doing it, if you internally think that you should be doing it, just go and do it. Go and try it. Have a go and you never know what could happen.
Yeah. Don't you know, letting other people suppress your own internal motivation. And sometimes they do that because they've got their agenda. They need you to be Olympic, otherwise they don't get paid. That's a fairly common agenda. But the other thing that other people stop your dream expanding is that they don't want to see you get hurt. Yeah, the people close to you and people who love you genuinely, you tell them you're going to go and be, you're going to take up SUP and be world champion, and they'll pat you on the back and go, oh, yeah, maybe you should have a backup plan, love. Yeah, don't put all your eggs in one basket, because they don't want to see you fail in a way. Yeah. And failure is the most likely outcome. If you want to be a world champion, the most likely outcome is you won't be. Because that's just how probability works. So a lot of people want to protect you by saying, "Oh, don't put all your eggs in that basket." So you got to be careful of people who don't have your interests at heart, but equally of people who do have your interests at heart, but they're coming at it from the wrong way. Yeah, and I think
it's really strange how fantastic failure is in a way. Like, you just cannot get the learning. And like, I've never been afraid to go to a race. I've never been afraid to put myself out there. And yeah, if I failed, like, that's fine. And I just work out what I did wrong, and then I try and do it again. And then I might fail again. And then eventually you fail so many times, you eventually reach your goal. And you failed 50 times before you reach your goal. But hey, it was worth it in the end.
But not, I think the most truly awesome person at that is Oscar, who's never failed, simply because he never accepts that a failure happened.
Yeah.
It never happened. What do you mean, failure? Yeah, and he deals with it in such a way that it still remains a positive, even though it was a negative. And yeah, he is quite extraordinary, as we all know anyway. He's a bit of a character. I mean, the first time I ever met him, I gave him a proper beating in a flat water 20K race in South Africa, and then needed a lift back to Cape Town, which was 4 hours away. And he offered me a lift, and he spent 4 hours explaining to me exactly why he's better than me. And by the end, I believed him, you know. Yeah. I was thinking, look, maybe you're right, man. Maybe you're right. I've learned Oscar since, and Oscar's one of my best friends now. He really is. Yeah, I genuinely love the guy. And so many people could learn so much from him in different aspects of how he's approached things. And he just confused the shit out of me. I'm thinking, I just gave you a proper dick in, right? And now he's telling me that I didn't. And he was so sure that I didn't that I started doubting myself.
Yeah.
And I just thought, that's just incredible, incredible way of dealing with what could have been a negative for him. He just bulldozed that, bulldozed it. He'd never even considered that might be a loss. And I've learned him so well now that he fascinates the hell out of me, as do all those guys, which is why I guess you're talking to them and to Hank and people like that. They just hold a fascination for you. You think, wow, what is it about you that you just don't see reality?
Yeah. There's so many great stories.
You bend the reality to suit how my reality is. That's how I'll do it. And I'm sure we all do that to probably a greater extent than the people who take the reality as a bruising.
Yeah.
And I think you're dead right.
I think an Oscar loss is a perfect way to end this conversation.
I think that's half. Sorry, Oscar. I think he'll
enjoy that more than anyone. I really appreciate your time today, mate. It's been
great fun.
I've really enjoyed the laughs and the stories and the ups and downs and everything that you've had in your career. So I really appreciate your time. Just speaking to everybody out there who's been watching the Boothcast, brought to you by Booth Training. Thank you so much for watching. If you want to check it out, please listen on iTunes or Spotify, or you can check out Michael Booth on Facebook, and there's a video section there called Boothcast. Mate, again, thank you so much for coming on.
Cool. Thank you. I really appreciate you feeling I'm worth having on. That's really cool.
That was awesome. I had so many good laughs then. I really enjoyed chatting to you. So thanks so much again.
Nice one. Thanks a lot.